You're listening to The Kevin O'Connor Show. That's coming up next. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin O'Connor Show. Today, we get a good one with Larry Nance Jr. coming on later to talk about the life of Kobe Bryant. We went through a bunch of old stories, talked about Kobe when we were fans to when he was a player. It was a really good conversation, and I appreciate Larry coming on to talk about Kobe. But before that, we got Tom Haverstraw talking about all the latest news in the NBA this week, a bunch of trade ideas as well. Really fun conversation with Tom that's coming up right now. All right, Tom, we know the starters for the NBA All-Star teams. Of course, we have to figure out how those are going to be shuffled up, but we do know the East and West starters voted on by the fans, media, and players. Well, one guy who was not named an All-Star was Jimmy Butler. News came out that he was suspended this week for another two games after missing a team flight. And we had a whole bunch of news kind of operating around that Butler suspension with the Suns making a trade. The Suns traded their unprotected 2031 first round pick to the Utah Jazz, and that's going to them for three firsts. They get the worst of first round picks via the Cavs, Wolves, or Jazz in 25, 27, and 29. So my understanding from this deal is that Phoenix did this. Well, for the Jazz, it's obvious. They get the highest value pick in the draft. They consolidate. But for Phoenix, my understanding, talking to sources, is that this isn't necessarily to set them up for Butler. It helps them get Butler. But more than anything else, this just opens options. For a long time, they've been trying to flip Yusuf Nurkic. Well, they haven't had a first-round pick to attach to him that made any sense to attach to him. Now they do. And what if there's no deals to be made? What if Bradley Beal is unwilling to waive his no-trade clause? And what if you can't get Jimmy Butler or anybody else? Well, you know, maybe there's something this summer. Maybe this summer Devin Booker or Kevin Durant asks out and you have to rebuild. Well, guess what? You have three firsts and you have the ability to trade multiple firsts now. And maybe you get six firsts for Devin Booker or four firsts for KD, some massive haul. And then suddenly you have over 10 first round picks. So I think for them, it just simply restores this previously empty cupboard of draft picks. And now they can trade up to three plus swaps in the coming years. I'm blown away by what the Suns did, because now they have a ton of versatility to get creative as we near the deadline here.
It was great work. It was great work. When you look at the Suns and their leverage in these negotiations, they were cornered because they only had that 2031 to send. Like, let's say in that three-team proposal where we earlier talked about the Detroit Pistons taking Bradley Beal's contract and then the Miami Heat getting Tobias Harris, Tim Hardaway, and some picks or whatever it is. The Suns only had one pick. Where are you going to send it? To Detroit or to Miami? The talks would be dead at that point because they only have one trade to offer to either of those clubs or any team looking to get into this action. The Suns basically took a nice pizza slice and cut it into thirds. But the thirds are like, if you cut the pizza horizontally, like, they're not great equally sized picks here. They're the last of the least favorable of Cleveland and Minnesota in 25 and 27 and 29. And so you're basically guaranteeing that it's going to be either, you know, a 20th pick or worse in those first round picks, given the trajectories of those two clubs. And I think that by doing that, it gives them optionality. And I think it also builds a lot more credibility in these trade talks, that they don't have to accept the first option because the other team knows that they are hamstrung from an asset standpoint. So it loosens up the trade talks, but also builds up the position of the Phoenix Suns. And so, yeah, the Nurkic contract, Ryan Dunn, if he is put onto the table before this deal, you're really stuck. But now you kind of feel like, all right, we have some options here. We have some first round picks to boost up our cupboard. And I do think that Phoenix did well to split it up. But Utah getting that 2031, and talk about one of the all time backfires. If that pops up in 2031 in the top five, it is completely unprotected. And so you know why Utah did it. And I also know why Phoenix did it, to just improve their optionality.
Well, I mean, that's the interesting thing for Phoenix. You know, like, the pizza slice analogy is good, because like, there might be a team that wants the crust. They just might want that piece. And they'll say, okay, we'll do it for that 27. They get to pick and choose whatever one that they view as that preferable piece of those three first. Whereas previously, as you said, Tom, with Dunn or Oso, their rookie backup center, teams might say, well, we need him as the sweetener. Well, Now it's a bit easier for Phoenix to, from their standpoint, with more leverage, to say, no. You get this 2025. That's all we're given in this situation.
Wait. KO, so you buried the lead. Are you a crust guy? Like when you order a pizza, are
depends.
You some...
Depends. Okay. All depends on the type of pizza. All depends. Some pizza I could do without the crust, toss it away. You take it. Other pizza, it's like, give me the crust or I'm not interested in even having this pizza.
Yeah, I feel like...
I come from South Shore, Massachusetts, and we have a very distinguished style of pizza here. South Shore, Massachusetts bar pizza. And it's like 10-inch, you know, kind of a personal size pizza that's like crispy on the outside of the crust, soft and buttery on the inside. It's very different than like New York style, which is kind of floppy and large. It's different than Chicago and all that. Like all these different styles. Detroit's way different, everything, right?
New Haven style, as a Connecticuteer myself.
New Haven style's great.
It's closer to bar pizza than it is New York pizza.
Exactly. Much closer to bar pizza. But like, that's my favorite type of pizza, and I want the crust.
Yeah, to me, leftover pizza, like if you, like my girls, if we get pizza and I have some leftovers, like a pizza crust is basically like a garlic breadstick in disguise. Like if you heat it up and then you throw some olive oil on it, some garlic, some Parmesan, you can't really beat that. So I'm always a fan of holding on.
Very, very fancy, Tom. I just heat it up or eat it cold. I'm a savage.
I don't know. A cold crust? Oil.
Yeah.
That feels like a heavily protected second round pick, in my opinion.
God, I love cold pizza. I like cold Italian food. I'll take out leftover chicken parm and eat it out of the fridge.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Cold
now we're
Italian?
Talking.
Okay. Yeah. Good. Glad we're on the same page here.
Yeah. Well, I do think that the Jimmy Butler trade, like, it becomes more likely, right, Kev? Like, it becomes more likely after this Phoenix Suns trade. But like you said, It does feel like the Suns have a little bit more ability to be picky here. Is like the conversations get a lot more intense. And I just think that Jimmy Butler coming into that Portland game where he comes back and he wears the Phoenix Suns colorway, it's just, you know, like, wow. Like the trolling that he's doing, and then he misses the team flight. Here's the report from Anthony Chang from Miami Herald. With Jimmy Butler in Miami on Wednesday night after the Heat suspended him for two games, he made an appearance at the Reserve Cup draft and dinner hosted by Moncayo Ocean Club. Butler is listed as an honorary chairman and co-captain for this weekend's Padel tournament in Miami. So I know he has some business arrangements that he's, you know, going to be an ambassador for these companies. Every player has endorsements or some sort of, you know, business relationships, but still, it just seems like this was maybe the last time we've seen Jimmy Butler in a Heat uniform. And honestly, with the trade deadline a couple of weeks away, I think it's reached its time. I think the trade talks have run its course.
Jimmy Butler's selfish. This is a big slap in the face of the fans. I know for him, this is about, you know, getting back at Pat Riley. This is about getting his money. It's not about winning. Otherwise, he'd be open to certain other teams. It's about getting his long-term contract above all else. But I just think this is the biggest slap in the face to the Heat fans after you had some good years there. It tarnishes what you built there and what you did. Because at this point, the Heat fans I know in my life, they're like, just get this guy out of here. It shouldn't be ending this way. But it is because of him.
And the Blazers blow it. The Blazers blew him out the other night. And what stood out to me is Spo benched Jimmy Butler and Bam Adebayo for this basically the entire second half. It was like there was a rally of the Heat second unit that were coming back and rallying back from like a 25-point deficit. And they didn't bring back Jimmy. They didn't bring back Bam, which to me was Spo, you know, maybe it's just getting rest and load managing. Why bring it back in a blowout? But to me, it was significant message to Bam and Jimmy is like, no one's above not bringing the effort. If you don't bring up the effort, if you're not playing team basketball, your ass is going to be on the bench. And I thought that was a pretty big statement is they didn't play in the fourth quarter against a Portland Trailblazers team that is rebuilding and not in a position to be blowing out title contending teams. And it's very clear that this Miami Heat core, not title contending and not giving the best effort.
Do you think Bam is actually a keeper from Miami? Because if I asked that question a year ago, I'd think it was just absolutely stupid to even ask it. He's a top defender in the NBA. He was expanding his range as a shooter. He was still very good as a roller. This year, he's career low from two-point range, still finishing at the rim at a poor rate in comparison to what he did before. Defensively, as you said, the effort level is not the same right now. He's 27 years old, getting paid a hell of a lot of money. Bam is playing like a guy that I wouldn't want to commit that amount of money to unless you're guaranteeing me he goes back to his all-star form. But for all the crying from Bam, I'm not getting defensive player of the year, I'm not getting voted like I should. Well, you're not showing why on the court this season. You're not showing that you have resilience battling through adversity here. So from a Heat perspective, I feel like Bam is getting pulled down by this whole Jimmy Butler thing too. Whereas somebody like Tyler Hero, you're seeing him lift his game up. He's getting better. Other Miami Heat guys like Hawkes have not been as good either. For the Heat, it just feels like they're not going to have any clarity with what they have with some of these talented young players until they eliminate the Jimmy Butler distraction at this point. So I'm hopeful that they can make a deal, but that's going to come down to a lot of X factors here that, you know, Beal no trade clause, whether Phoenix even wants to do it for whatever the price is, if another team pops up, if Memphis comes out of nowhere, even though Butler, no guarantee he'd get a long-term deal there, could be a team that he doesn't want to go to. But it's a lot of X factors here for Miami that make things difficult. But at the end of the day, the Heat just feel like a what-do-we-have team right now, whereas last year it was a we know what we have, we just got to get a little bit better.
Who would have thought that people would say Tyler Hero is the face of this franchise going forward, not Bam Adebayo? Jeez. But he's taken a big step back. Like, Bam has had a very disappointing season. The three-point shot has not been as advertised. The expansion of his game, like you said, hasn't been there. I mean, we've seen Pat Riley, you know, demand, you know, challenge Bam Adebayo to become a 20-point scorer in today's NBA. Now he's at 15. You know, this is not a guy who's taken a step forward. If anything, he's taken a step back, a big step back this season. And I still hold out hope because defensively, I mean, it was an aberration the other night against the Blazers, but defensively over the entire season, he's been a top five, top 10 defender at his position. But I think when you look at the overall scope of this team and the cloud that Jimmy Butler has brought, Bam Adebayo has been one of the biggest casualties of this fog that they've been in. It's been, I mean, if you did the top five, top 10 most disappointing players this season, Bam Adebayo is close on that list.
That's a good segment for us. We'll do an all disappointment team at some point later in the year. I mentioned the Bradley Beal stuff. And earlier in the week, there is from the Arizona Republic, Mark Bartlestein, the agent for Bradley Beal, came out on the record for the second time about this Bradley Beal stuff. And Bartlestein came out and said, the reports that are out there are created out of thin air. And that was about Beal lifting his no trade clause for these are the teams mentioned, the Bucks, the Nuggets, the Heat, or the Lakers. Now, I find that pretty interesting that those are the teams mentioned because you did not hear the Chicago Bulls, the Detroit Pistons, those two teams, particularly the Bulls. The Bulls are interesting because The Athletic, the same day, reported in a group post that the Bucks' goals are to cut enough salary to get under the second apron, which would allow them to trade enough salaries to aggregate together. And the goal is to get perhaps Beal or a star like Chicago's Zach LaVine. Now, that's interesting to me, Tom, because a few weeks ago, when this Butler stuff was still in the early, you know, days, it might have even been a month ago for that matter, one source said to me, one of the primary hopes for Phoenix getting rid of Beal is Chicago. And I had heard nothing about that since then. Zero, nothing. Nobody mentioned Chicago as a destination for Beal. So I just kind of, you know, filed it away like, okay, this might be nothing. It might be total BS. But it's just interesting that this comes up now as we approach the deadline that the Bucks could be going after Zach LaVine. Now, there's a deal to be done there. I was on Bill Simmons' podcast on Wednesday night. I laid this out to Bill. The deal could be something like this, Tom, where you see the Bucks get LaVine, the Suns get Butler, the Bulls get Beal, the Heat get Chris Middleton and Pat Connaughton, and then the Pistons or some other team could take on Bobby Portis. And that works financially. Then you would spread out some picks amongst those teams that deserve them. Like, I think, you know, Bulls would get something for taking Beal instead of LaVine. I'm sure the Heat would want something in there as well. But a deal like that just feels like it makes sense. It just makes sense to everybody, for that matter. Heat get rid of Butler. Bucks upgrade from Middleton with his bad ankles to LaVine. Pistons get a versatile center for their front court rotation in Portis. Suns get Butler. I think there's something there. I really do, when you're connecting all the dots.
LaVine's good, man. He's really awesome. Good. Under the radar. A guy who, I was just running the numbers here a second ago. Shaedon Sharpe has made a three-pointer in each of his last 23 games. And a big reason why is because his pull-up game has improved by so much. He's shooting 40% on pull-up threes during that streak. The number one guy in pull-up threes this year, or at least since December 1st, is Zach LaVine, and it's by a mile. 47% since December 1st. Almost 50% of his threes going in off the bounce. That is so big for a guy who's that athletic, a guy who's that smooth, a guy who is that big, and is someone that, like, the Warriors could absolutely use a Zach LaVine. Then you're like, wait, how many teams wouldn't use a Zach LaVine when he's scoring this well, three-level scorer, exciting player who's got a couple more years on his contract, which a couple years ago looked like an albatross, like a terrible deal. But as we're seeing the cap spike here in the next 4 or 5 years, you're looking at Zach LaVine's deal and being like, wait a minute, is that such a bad deal? And if you're trying to win, that's what stars go for these days. And Zach LaVine is absolutely playing like a star. And next is Damian Lillard and Giannis Antetokounmpo. He would be a huge upgrade over a guy, Chris Middleton. I love what he's done over his career, Kev. But if you can't move, if both your ankles are shot, they got to make a move fast. And Zach LaVine would be an amazing coup for them.
Now, if the Bulls were to indeed have a willingness to take on Bradley Beal, and the reason why they might is because Billy Donovan was his college coach at Florida. They could reunite together. Maybe Beal, you know, he restores some of his value, and then the Bulls could flip him at some point towards the end of his contract. Or maybe they keep him. Maybe he just gets better. But for Chicago, you get picks. If you're Phoenix, I said this to Bill, and he agreed with me. I'm not sure you will agree with me. I said I'd rather have LaVine than Butler if I'm the Phoenix Suns. Do you agree with that statement?
No, I don't. Just the same problem we had with Bradley Beal is the duplicitous role, the skill set of Kevin Durant, Devin Booker, and Zach LaVine. To me, I need an intense playoff razor. That's Jimmy Butler. Over the last 6 years, Jimmy Butler has the second highest win shares of any player in the last six postseasons. The only guy who's better is Nikola Jokic. The guy raises his play in the postseason in a way that we need from a team that has Kevin Durant and Devin Booker, two guys that just got swept last year and are on the verge of being in the play-in. I want Jimmy Butler's attitude, penetration, the ability to score in the mid-range. I know the three-point shot isn't there in the regular season, but in the postseason, he shows an ability to step back from three and hit it at a high percentage. And defensively, if he doesn't have to be the number one guy on your offense, I think he is a lot more able and capable and has the disposition to guard the opposing best player and be that hound and create turnovers on the defensive end. Is Zach LaVine, Bradley Beal that guy? I don't think so. For me, the two-way upside and just the leadership, I know it's weird to say leadership, but this guy did carry that Miami Heat team to two finals trips. I do think that kind of asset, that skills of Jimmy Butler on and off the floor, it's just a better fit to me with Phoenix than Zach LaVine.
Yeah, he's so old, though. That's where I have concerns. I mean, I know you're old as is with KD, and there's a, you know, an end of the road with him at some point. LaVine's still only 29, turns 30 in March. He's younger, just an elite shooter, 45% from three on catch and shoots the last four of the last 5 years, 37% from three on dribble jumpers last 4 or 5 years. Like, these are elite marks for a guy. Great mid-range shooter, great at-rim finisher, lob guy. But to your point, he does not bring the defense in the way Jimmy Butler can. He does not bring the downhill rim penetration, foul drawing that Jimmy Butler does. And that's something that they're missing. Like, Butler does fill more of those what the Suns are missing gaps. LaVine is just kind of like what you wish Bradley Beal was, right? Like that, like that's what I view him as. But ultimately, a lot to shake out with that situation in the coming weeks. Who knows when that shoe actually drops? Maybe it'll happen randomly and we'll do an emergency podcast. To our YouTube audience, give this video a thumbs up. Audio listeners, please subscribe to the Kevin O'Connor Show during this break. All right, Tom, you wrote about something on Yahoo Sports on Thursday. You said why the Spurs should trade for Stephen Curry. This is a great article to read on Yahoo after earlier in the week I wrote about, hey, the Warriors should blow it up.
Yeah.
I made the case for that. I laid out some fake trades within that article on Yahoo Sports. But one of the teams that I didn't have as a Steph team for this season was the Spurs. I said that's more of an off-season thing. You made the case for Steph to the Spurs. Make it to me here, Tom, and listeners.
The rookie scale contract is why you make a deal for Steph Curry. The rookie scale hack is something that no one is talking about, but they absolutely should. The fact that Victor Wembanyama is going to be paid like a less than a mid-level exception over the next 2.5 years is why you make a deal for Steph Curry. Because his deal is exactly lockstep with Victor Wembanyama's rookie scale contract. So yeah, who's going to take Stephen Curry's $62 million deal that he's going to be getting in 26, 27? Well, when Victor Wembanyama's making $16 million that year, you can convince yourself that, hey, I got those two dudes for basically $80 million going forward for the next 2 years. I'm getting the best shooter ever paired with what might be the best defender ever. You've got a guy who's leadership-wise, you want to bring into any organization. He's an impeccable record when it comes to setting the tone for your franchise, setting the right habits, being a team-first guy. You put that guy next to Wemby, it's going to be a lot like playing 7-on-5. And you bring him in now because I think if you're the San Antonio Spurs, you can see what you have as early as you can in what you need to build around Victor Wembanyama. And of course, like people are going to say it's too early. But man, have you seen KOC, the history of teams that made big swings when they have a stud, a budding superstar on their rookie contract? It's a lot more hits than misses. Look at Dwayne Wade. In 2004, when Pat Riley had the opportunity to get Shaq, he didn't blink twice. He's like, go get me Shaq. He's 2 years removed from being a finals MVP, and he's going to be a guy that we can build right next to Dwayne Wade, who was finishing up a great rookie season. But 2 years later, he's the finals MVP. And it's all because of that rookie scale contract where, yes, he was great, but they were able to do it when he was making $3 million as the finals MVP. He was making half of what James Posey, Jason Williams, and Antoine Walker was making. Okay, so Victor Wembanyama right now, the Spurs have a window here where he's not going to be paid like $50, $60 million. He's going to be paid $10, $11, $15, $16 million. And that is how you build a championship contender and do it before it's too late. You look at Shaq in Orlando, look at LeBron in Cleveland, you look at Yao Ming in Houston. You want to make sure you strike while it's hot. And I think Wemby is this good, this now, and the Spurs should ramp up right now with Steph Curry.
It's a good argument. The rookie scale aspect is a great argument, taking advantage when Victor's still cheap. My concern, just to push back here, Tom, is how many picks are you willing to give up here? Because if you're the Spurs, let's say you get Steph. Let's say you get Steph and the salary matching that you could do is Keldon Johnson, Harrison Barnes, and Zach Collins. Let's just say it's those three. So your starting five would be Steph, Stephon Castle, you get to keep him, Devin Vassell, Jeremy Sochan, Victor Wembanyama. You get Chris Paul coming off the bench for a big change of pace from the Steph starting five. You get Trey Jones still. You have two guards, Julian Champagne, who's good. It's a shallow team. But no, that's what you got.
You got Steph and Wemby.
But you got Steph. You do. But is it worth? Is it worth giving up four firsts, five firsts, when 2 to 3 years from now, Victor's going to be even better and you might have more. Sochan will be better. Castle will be better and the supporting cast will be better. But Steph might be retired. Is it worth compromising all of those future assets during the time where you might actually need them? That's my concern.
You can always flip Steph Castle or Devin Vassell or Steph Curry if Charlotte calls and say, hey, we want Steph Curry to come home. Here's a couple firsts. Like, there's ways. We saw Kristaps Porzingis in Dallas. Luka was Wemby-esque, like first couple years in the league, like already this guy's a star in the league, all NBA talent, right away, right out of the box. So they go and they make the Kristaps Porzingis trade. Doesn't work out. Kev, what happened? They went to the finals 2 years later. Even if the big swing doesn't pan out in the ways you were hoping for, a lot of times you can pivot because either Kristaps Porzingis can get something or you have other draft picks in the next couple years that you can toss and be able to get another guy. So with Stephen Castle, with Devin Vassell, with Stephen Curry, I'm not saying Chris Paul is going to get you a first round pick, but there's ways you can pivot out of that. And I do think that in the age of sustainable building long-term, the long view, we want to have be patient as we build sustainable. I think sometimes we're not aggressive enough to try and go for it now. I mean, we could be in a situation for Wemby. Hopefully he stays healthy. But what if Steph Castle doesn't turn out to be a great all-star player that I think he can be? But a lot of this is not linear. And I mean, Andrew Wiggins, the Cleveland Cavaliers had Kyrie Irving on the fourth year of his rookie scale contract. They get LeBron. They're like, Andrew Wiggins, bye. We're getting Kevin Love. Andrew Wiggins at that point, I don't know what you thought about Kev, what you thought about his ceiling as a player.
I had I had Joel Embiid 1, Jabari Parker 2. Andrew Wiggins 3.
Okay. Fair. He was all over the map that year. A lot of people thought he was Maple Jordan,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, he was. Like, yeah, to a lot of people, yep.
They were willing to make that gamble because, like, you got LeBron, you got Kyrie on this rookie scale contract for another year. You could fit these contracts in. Go for it. And I don't know. I think the NBA, obviously, has had a great run with the Warriors with Steph and the Warriors. But like you said, it might be time to blow it up. And I do think the Spurs should be on that list of potential trade suitors for Steph and Curry because of that rookie four-year window. And look, maybe it's not Steph. Maybe the argument against this is not necessarily the ethos around that idea of building right now for Victor Wembanyama because he's already MVP candidate at 21 years old. Maybe the argument is you hold on to those assets in case Giannis comes available, in case Anthony Edwards becomes available, and then you put all your money and all your assets forward to the table. But then again, what if they don't? Or what if Wemby, you know, I don't know. I just feel like in year five or year six, we tend to think of things as being, it's really hard to predict the future, but bird in the hand, Steph Curry is still a top 10 player in the league. And what if that guy does not become available in the next couple of years and you just wasted the rookie scale years, which is a huge piece to building a title contender and even a champion is that rookie scale year. Look, Tim Duncan did it. Tim Duncan, David Robinson. Like, they won a championship in those rookie scale years because they were able to keep that core together around Tim Duncan, who was making pennies compared to what his value was.
Well, I mean, that's why, you know, last year when Victor was a rookie, before even he made his debut, when he was drafted, I made the argument that the Spurs should go get Brook Lopez and they should try to go get some veterans and they should try to win with Victor. And my argument was because by the end of the year, he's going to be one of the 25 best guys. I think he ended up one of the 15 best players at the end of last season. I had him on one of my all-NBA teams. This year, I think he's top 5, 6, 7, that general range. He's already one of the top 10 guys without a question because of his defense and what he can bring on offense as well. The Spurs, they have 9 first-round picks that can be traded. They have 12 total incoming. So if they gave up 4 in a swap for Steph, you still have a lot left over as well. So there's an argument to be made that you have so many to cash in. You should just cash some in now and optimize your chances when Victor's cheap. And if Giannis or somebody else does become available at some point, are we sure OKC's going to go for him with their picks? I'm not, considering their team situation. Are we sure he'd want to go to Brooklyn? Are we sure he'd want to go to Utah? We're not. We can't be sure about that. He might want to go to Houston. They'd be a legitimate contender, but the Spurs would still have a lot of picks to at least put themselves in it. And plus, he'd have the connection with Steph there. if he were to become available. And I don't think he will necessarily. I just don't. I'd be surprised right now unless things really go sour for the Bucks like they did at the beginning of this season. But it wasn't too long ago we were talking about Giannis trades. It was October, November when we were.
I mean, it just, I feel like when we look at the history of the NBA, it's easy to say, look, we should just hold and wait on Wemby. Wait a few years when he's in his prime. But there's just as many examples, and LeBron is the most famous one, of you didn't build around this guy quick enough, and he was out. I mean, Orlando with Shaq, it was a situation about money and that the Lakers came in and offered him a crazy contract compared to what the Orlando was doing. But we like to think that in year two of what they were building in Orlando, like, they're not going to lose Shaq. I'm not saying Wemby's going to, like, has any inclination to leave San Antonio. But we tend to think of things in the future with rose-colored glasses, or at least that things are going to continue the way they are. And I just feel like with a guy like Stephen Curry, who has not been made available, I should say this for all the Warriors fans watching, he has not been made available. But I think the Spurs should be ready in case it does happen, because I don't know how many teams have both the cap flexibility, the young players, and the picks to and the desire to trade for Stephen Curry at this point in his career and his contract. And the Warriors would want to get the package from the San Antonio Spurs.
Do you agree with me with my argument that I made on Yahoo, and, you know, I alluded to it with Bobby Marks in the podcast earlier this week, that the Warriors should at least be considering blowing it up here, that that's for their best interest moving forward, similar to, you know, as I wrote on Yahoo, KG and Pierce, Celtics traded them in 2013. They weren't quite clearly about to fall off a cliff, but the declines were beginning to decline. The signs of decline were beginning to show. They get a massive haul from the Brooklyn Nets. To me, like, Steph, he's still top 10, but he's not top 3 right now. Career low numbers, volume wise, efficiency wise, since the first 3-4 years of his career before the Warriors were the Warriors. The injuries. Right now, Draymond as well having some injuries. The Golden State Warriors, if they wanted to trade both of those guys, either to the same place or to different places, could just get an enormous package in return. Just significant. And then they'd be tanking in years in which you have Cooper Flagg as a prize this year, AJ DeBonta as a prize next year, among others in 26. The 26 class could have 3 quality number one pick worthy guys. So this is the time to tank. Like, this is a window to suck this year and next year for some of these guys. Granted, the draft lottery isn't 25% odds for worst record anymore. That's why you don't have to bottom out entirely. You can have the 7th worst record and feel good about your odds to move up.
I mean, the thing is, you have to make sure Draymond and Steph are on board, right?
Why? This is me being cutthroat, ruthless, heartless, but why? Why do they need to be on board if, for the franchise, it may not be in the best interest to keep them moving forward? Why do they have to be on board?
I don't think you want that stain on your franchise.
You don't want that energy?
That energy, it depends. If Wemby's coming in the trade package for Steph, the fan base will not pick it and just riot in the streets in San Francisco.
Is that why? Because I don't think you can worry about the fans. I don't think that should be a concern even in the slightest. I think the concern would need to be just if Steph is adamant that he wants to stay and he's like, you're ruining my family. we want to be here for the next 2.5 years. I don't care how bad we are. Tank with me. If he's making the strongest argument ever there, then maybe. But at the same time, what if 6 first-round picks are on the table and here's a guy who's talking about we need to leave the franchise in a better place than it was when we got here? It already is. The value has gone up from $450 million when Laker bought it to over $9 billion, billion with a B. The franchise is already in a better spot. And if you can go somewhere else and try to contend for championships and the franchise that you want to leave in a better place can get 5 or 6 firsts for you, that is doing what you say you set out to do.
Did the whole LeBron leaving Miami and Dwayne Wade leaving the Heat, did that lower their stature in across the league about coming stars coming to Miami?
No.
I don't know.
I don't think so.
I don't know. I don't know.
I don't think so.
But, I mean, Pat Riley said people talked about
Boston trading Isaiah Thomas after he played through injury and had heroic performances in the playoffs after he lost his sister.
Steph isn't and Isaiah. Come on, man.
I know he's not, but I'm just saying simply the idea of nobody's ever going to want to play there. Nobody's ever going to want to re-sign there and stay in Boston. I just don't buy that. I think anytime there's controversy, people forget about it in a week and nobody actually cares. So I think like that's why if you're the Warriors or whatever team, you have to do what's best for you and for your fans, for your franchise moving forward. And I know that just sounds heartless. I know it does. But it's just the way I grew up as a Boston sports fan. I saw it happen over and over with my favorite players being traded and it led to winning. I think you have to make those tough decisions sometimes.
You're talking about the Red Sox here with Noma.
Yeah. I'm talking about with the Patriots cutting Lawyer Malloy a week before the 0-3 season. They lose 31-0 in week one against the Bills. Then they beat the Bills week 17, 31-0, final week of the season. Then they go on to win a Super Bowl. Lawyer Malloy gets cut. I remember all the talk on Boston Sports Radio was, what are the Patriots doing cutting their Pro Bowl safety? What are they doing here? We can't trust Belichick. They got lucky the year they won the Super Bowl. They're not going to win another one. And then they go on and win two more. And then they win three more down the line. They go to many others. Like, I just, to me, like, I think you, sometimes those are the tough decisions you have to make. It'd be awesome if he can be a lifer. But here's the thing. If you're going to keep Steph and if you're going to keep Draymond, you have to give those guys the best opportunity to win it. To me, that's more of a slap in the face than trading them. It's a bigger slap in the face to keep the guy and he's winning 40 games every year. That, to me, that's the most insulting thing you can do. If you're ranking the biggest.
Number one is not trading him to the San Antonio Spurs. Number one is keeping him and not trading your future first round draft picks in order to build around him. So like, that's kind of the way I feel about it. I don't know if that's twisted, but the lifer stuff to me is like, it doesn't change his legacy at all if he doesn't spend his whole career wearing one jersey.
Well, it's just the reason why I say it is not so much the fans. I guess I mentioned that, but what I was also going to get to was the players and whether they feel like, hey, watch out for that. There's snakes over there in Golden State. They told him one
everywhere.
Thing. I'm just saying, like,
I know
I would feel really, that would be really tough for me to trade Steph. Mm-hmm. Steph Curry made that Joe Lacob and that organization $6 billion. That just seems out of succession, man. And maybe the Lacobs are succession and they are Logan Roy, but it does feel like that would be, I mean, that was a TV show, but like the idea is like, you really are that cold hearted that even if Steph wanted to stay there with his family, you're going to trade him to Memphis or wherever. That's tough. But I will say, the Nomar situation, it had run its course when Boston traded him for Orlando Cabrera and Dougie Mint. Like that feels like a moment where, yeah, it was Nomar Garciaparra, but it wasn't peak Nomar coming after the wrist injury and just the weird dynamics with the front
A-Rod
office.
Stuff prior to the year prior, right?
We don't have that with Steph right now.
Yeah.
Like Steph is still a top 10 player, which we could not say about Nomar Garciaparra at that time. And I do think that...
guys can fall off fast though, Tom.
Yeah.
They can fall off real quick. KG went from still like top 10 defensive player to averaging 20 minutes per game and averaging 3 points in the matter of 2 years. It can happen fast. We might be seeing it right now with Paul George. The signs of decline for Steph, I'm telling you, still top 10, but he's not the same level he was even last year. And that's where it's like, well, wait a minute. What if it's about to begin? What if it is? What if it is?
Do you know what the fountain of youth in the NBA is? It's Victor Wembanyama. Have you seen how good Chris Paul has been this year compared to last year?
Oh,
if you play next to Victor Wembanyama, the things he does defensively for Steph Curry and the things offensively for Steph Curry, I mean, he's going to add 2 years to his career. He's going to, just by virtue playing with Wemby, Steph Curry is going to be playing into it.
I agree. For the Spurs, yes. But for the Warriors... He's like Steve Kerr still got him running around all game.
Yeah.
All game.
I know.
Miles are adding up more and more and more and more and more.
We are not far away from the post Achilles Kobe Bryant era. If with the kind of like supporting cast and how bad they are without Steph Curry. Like that Lakers team where they're just trotting out Kobe Bryant because he's Kobe. It just feels like to me, you make the trade sooner than later. Cause like you said, it could go down fast with Steph Curry and he's got some knee issues right now. But if I'm San Antonio, I'm not thinking twice about making that deal. I am making that deal 100 times. I remember Tim Duncan and David Robinson and what they did. I feel like it would be a similar thing with Victor Wembanyama and Steph Curry. And I think their fit would be even more seamless and compatible. I think if you're looking at OKC, how are we going to go beat OKC? You get the greatest shooter in the NBA.
I like it, Tom. I like it, Tom. I hope we get some rumors around Steph. This trade deadline or this offseason. For now, we just have a couple of news notes before I bring on Larry Nance to talk about the life of Kobe Bryant. We got Derek Lively news. Out for quite a while now with injury. The Mavericks now are going to be starting Daniel Gafford moving forward. Derek Lively out with a significant foot injury. This is bad news, man. Like multiple months, he's going to be out pushing against April when the playoffs began. I worry for Dallas, man. This could end up a lost year with all these injuries they've had. It just doesn't feel like good energy for them right now.
This to me is an example of why the NBA's parity era is really just the injury era. We talk about parity like it's about competitive balance and the CBA and all this stuff. We're discounting the fact that these star players, I know Derek Lively is not, you know, all-star, all-NBA caliber, but so many of these title contenders, their trajectory is ruined by injury. And the Dallas Mavericks are poster child for this season, where Luka Doncic is hurt, Kyrie Irving's in and out of the lineup earlier this season, Derek Lively gets hurt. It blows up any sort of trade opportunities where you can move either Daniel Gafford or Derek Lively to go get another guy. I think you and I had talked about Draymond Green potentially being in Dallas, and you move either Gafford or Derek Lively because you have two of these similarly talented players as vertical spacers, young guys who can play that role. You get a different guy in Draymond Green. This totally blows that up. And now we're going to see 1 year after they were in the Western Conference Finals that they're probably not going to get anywhere close to that this season. Why? Not because of parity. It's because of injuries. And I feel like when we look around the league and what is the reason why we haven't had back-to-back repeat champions, we're discounting the fact that these guys, these star players, are not playing nearly as much as they used to. So while there were dynasties or teams were going, the Pistons, the Bulls, the Celtics, star players are only playing 60, 70% of their games now. And that, above all else, is the reason why, I don't know why I got on this rant with Derek Lively, but it just, the fact that the Dallas Mavericks are maybe going to miss the playoffs this year after being so promising last year, getting to the NBA Finals, it's not because they made the wrong decisions. It's because player health is so much more fragile now than it used to be. And that, to me, is as much a reason why you're seeing parity in the NBA than anything.
I think that's spot on, Tom. That's a big part of it with parity. There was other news. Jared Vanderbilt coming back to the Lakers on Saturday. Finally get a look at him. I mean, all year long, Lakers fans in my life have been joking about how Pelinka's not going to make a move until Jared Vanderbilt's back. Well, here he is on Saturday. You're going to get a look at Jared Vanderbilt. That's great for them to get him back with that defensive versatility. They need the help. Their defense is not able to stop any penetration at all. So adding him is a big boost for their defense, hopefully. You mentioned Kobe Bryant earlier, Tom. I'm bringing on Larry Nance Jr. coming up next to talk about his life. They played their Larry's rookie season together, was part of Kobe's final season. I'm just curious, Tom, do you have a favorite Kobe memory?
I just remember covering him in Miami, and it was, I want to say, 200 reporters for a regular season game around Kobe. It was insane. Like the ability for him to command the room and command just the entire NBA was in his hand, like at any point, just on court, off court. And then to see it with your own two eyes, how much of a big deal it was internationally and how many international reporters were flying into Miami just to talk to Kobe Bryant. I remember sitting next to Pau Gasol on that court at a shoot around. And it was just me getting a one-on-one with Pau because everybody wanted to go hear what Kobe had to say. And it was just this moment of like, man, this dude's he's different. He's different. Just not just the basketball stuff, but seeing in person how much of a magnetic personality he was. I'll never forget that scene where, as a 25-year-old covering the NBA, you just don't forget moments like that, where you just see a guy who has a complete, like that commercial, complete orchestration, command, conducting the entire league at his fingertips.
Dude was a monster player, man. Just unbelievable. As I say to Larry later in the podcast, I grew from hating him as a Celtics fan to just growing to, you know, hating to love him and then loving him towards the end. I remember his last game in Boston, similar scene where it's just like, nobody could, there's no air to breathe in the media room where they had Kobe. Everybody was just packed in like sardines. It was like riding the T after a Celtics game, but you were in a media room. It's just absolutely
smells just
crazy.
As bad too.
It smelled horrible in that room. I do remember the smell. Well, Tom, thank you for joining me today, man.
Hey, thanks for having me. And listen to The Big Number every week on Thursdays at Yahoo Sports. Dan Devine and I just did our All-Star Starters and broke it out in podcast form. So go listen to that. And thanks so much, KSC, for having me on. It's always a joy to do this every Thursday. And yeah, enjoy the weekend.
Go listen to Tom's The Big Number. Read him at The Finder for Substack and over at Yahoo Sports. Coming up next is me and Larry Nance Jr. talking about Kobe Bryant. Joining me today to remember Kobe Bryant is his former teammate, Larry Nance Jr. Larry, how you doing today?
I'm doing great. I appreciate you having me on, man.
Hard to believe it's been 5 years just about now since Kobe Bryant passed away. As everybody knows, he passed away in a helicopter crash with his daughter, 7 other passengers on that helicopter. You were a teammate of Kobe's when you were a rookie in his final season of his career. And the big night, of course, was the final night of his NBA career when you and him combined to score 68 points together.
Yeah.
What do you remember from that night having a front row seat watching Kobe?
Well, I mean, look, the 60 was a nice appetizer, but my 8 was the meal, you know, for what we all came for. You know, honestly, what a special night. Truly. I mean, that year was a really hard year. You know, obviously, like being a rookie year, you know, I was there with D'Angelo and Julius and Jordan Clarkson, and I'm trying to think who else. I mean, Caruso might have crossed paths. I mean, we had so many young guys there, so much young talent there. Then that, like, it was a tough year. You know, it was, I think we won 17, 18 games, something like that. But the joy on people's faces when they got to see Kobe in person for, you know, what they realized was the last time is just like, things I'll never forget. And I just can't imagine, like, I've done some cool things in my career. Hopefully I can do some more cool things, but like, I can't imagine what could take the place of that 60-point game. I mean, in terms of historic nights, like, I can't imagine what could take the place of that.
Were you guys on the court and on the bench just thinking, oh my, like looking up at the scoreboard, seeing like, oh, 40, 50, wait a minute, like he has a chance here. Like, what were you guys talking about on the bench that night watching him?
Oh, nothing but that. I mean, it was nothing but that. We were just counting every shot made, we knew what he had. He didn't even know what he had. You know, he was muscle memory took over at that point for him. So he was just in killer instinct mode. And we were the ones fangirling in game, like, oh my God, you have 54. And he's like, we got to win.
It was a close game too, right?
Like, it's funny enough, we were playing against Quinn Snyder's Jazz team. So here I am playing for the guy now.
Crazy. I mean, yeah, in that game, I mean, Kobe had 42 minutes in the game. I remember I was watching the game from home. I wasn't in the arena, but like, and that was one of the funnest games that I can remember like ever watching, really. And for you, rookie, like you said, 8 points off the bench. You played 28 minutes that night. Your rookie season's with Kobe Bean Bryant. You get drafted by the Lakers. You know you're going to be joining a legendary franchise, a legendary player. What was the first thing kind of on your mind when you're like, oh my God, I'm going to get to talk and be a teammate of Kobe Bryant?
I mean, the first thing is just like, you're so scared of that. Like, look, that was the one guy that you just knew, like, all right, I can't piss this guy off. Right. Like, and at that point, like the older generation of players was kind of on the way out, but like Kobe still had that mentality. Like KG was still in the league. There were certain guys that like, you just don't mess with. And so the first thing all of us were just like, all right, how do I get on this guy's good side? How do I stay? Like, what do I have to do for this guy to just not put me in his sights? And I mean, I found that out pretty easy. You know, for me, like, all he asked of us was everything we had. You know, that was it. And I can do that. You know, anybody can do that. You know, he didn't ask you to be a superstar. He didn't ask you to make every shot. He didn't ask you to, he just, whatever you got, I need it all. I need whatever you got, 100% of it. That's how I got on the court my rookie year. You know, it was just like defense and playing is harder than anybody else. And he just, I feel like we bonded over the fact that every possession we were both just trying to, we were both just trying at 100%. So we bonded over that.
Was there ever an instance that season, whether it involved you or somebody else, where you did see kind of that wrath of Kobe? Like, you're not giving your all. This guy's not messing around.
Yeah. There was one specific time was in Portland. Those Dame and CJ teams were tough to beat, you know, and we were a bad team. So we went up to Portland one time, and it was just it was an embarrassing game. I mean, like, it was one of those where, like, we were down from 30 and down by 30 immediately. We never had a sniff's chance. Like, it was over. He didn't play. But he was with us on the trip. And I'll never forget, like, B. Scott was talking to us in the locker room afterwards and was just kind of like, you know, hey, like, this is the NBA. There is no easy nights. Like, you guys are the easy night right now. Like, it's us. We're the easy night. You know, you got to prepare for that. Teams are, you know, just basically reading us the riot act. And, you know, Kobe walks in, and it was just one of those where, like, he walked in, and even Byron, like, just kind of sat back and turned to look at him like, what do you got for us? You know, I'm ready for my lashing. You know what I mean? Like, I'm ready. And, you know, it was funny because, you know, I was signed to Adidas. So I was wearing whatever I was wearing. But, you know, there were a few guys that were signed with Nike and were wearing Kobe's. And after that game, he points at it, like, just walks in the locker and we're waiting to say something. He goes, you, pointed at everybody with Kobe's. Take them off, put them in the trash. Leave them here. You're never wearing those again. They're mine. You're never wearing those again. And it was like a moment of like, oh, haha, funny. And then it became very, very, it happened very quickly that, like, he is not kidding. Like, he is not kidding. And so, like, the guys that were wearing them took them off and put them in the trash can. Like,
Not wear them again the rest of the season?
No. They left them there in Portland in the equipment trash can. Like, it was, they were never to be worn again. And they
What do they wear again the rest of the seasons? Like, Nike, like, LeBron's, Air Force Ones, even? Like, no. Like, what are guys wearing? No more Kobe's?
Nah, it was like, it was the specific shoe they were wearing. Okay. Like, tonight, like, this was so terrible, flush it. Like, these shoes that you guys wore, they like, you didn't play hard enough in them, throw them away. So you got to get, like, you got to buy a new pair, figure it out, but you're not wearing those shoes ever again.
God. Poor Nick Young, huh?
They didn't. No comment. I don't know who it was. I will say, speaking of Nick Young, I got one that not many would know. So before the last game and after the last game, Kobe was he was just incredible with us as teammates. Like, he would sign, if you asked for anything signed, he would just, oh, of course, man, absolutely. And so there was like a line of us after the game, just, we had our stuff that, like, hey, could you sign this for me? Can I get a picture? Like, you know, we're all fans at the end of the day. Mm-hmm. But so I'm standing in line. I got a pair of his shoes that I asked for unsigned. And so I want him to sign those. And I had like a jersey that I had bought. And so I have him sign these things. And it's like, man, thank you so much. It was an honor, like truly a joy of my career that I got to do this with you. You know, thank you for having me. And just, so, you know, told him what I had to tell him. And then after me was Nick Young, who again, notoriously signed, he was with Adidas, and he would wear Kobe's. He would wear Crazy 8s. And that was the only time Nick was like, hey, man, can I get you to sign these? And hand him the Crazy 8s. And Kobe was like, man, get these out of my sight. And like, put them in the trash can himself. And like, it was such a funny moment, because like, Nick and him always had that banter back and forth. And you always thought that, like, all right, it's the final game. Like, you know, he's just, you know, he's not even paying attention to us. He'll sign whatever. But it's like when Nick handed them shoes, it was like, no, he's not comfort. Like, this is who he is. He's not signing. Like, I'm not signing them. And it was funny because, like, again, of course, they had some banter back and forth. Nick had a jersey, too. And he signed that for him. But it was just like a funny moment of like, oh, this really is your guy's relationship. Like, it is a nonstop joke. And so, but no, I've been two separate times in 1 year. He made guys throw shoes away because they weren't fit to be in his presence.
It's kind of crazy. Like, as you kind of, you know, name some of the guys that were your teammates at that time, mm-hmm. It's wild that you're one of just the four guys still in the league that was on that roster: Jordan Clarkson, Julius Randle, D'Angelo Russell, and yourself. Yeah. Like, it's nuts. I mean, like, it was long ago. It was a decade ago, but it wasn't that long ago. But like, it was a young roster, and then there's not many of you guys still around. When Kobe passed 5 years ago, did you talk with your teammates at the time, or your ex-teammates at the time, kind of remembering whether calls or text messages on a thread or anything like that?
Yeah, I reached out to a few of them, you know, just kind of let them know, like, hey, man, thinking of you, hope you're doing all right. But that, I mean, that was such a, I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't want to talk about it. I don't necessarily want to talk about it. Like, I don't know. Like, he holds such a special place for me specifically. Like, the guy could have ended my career before it even started. He could have ended my career before it even started. You know, whenever you get a chance, and I'm sure whoever's listening will do the same thing, go, you know, you can go look up what happened on my draft night involving my Twitter and him. And he could have ended my career that very moment. And a lesser man, like I will say, like a lesser man, shoot, I might have ended that kid's career. And the way he just embraced me, it was like, man, water under the bridge, welcome to the team. And then from that point, just helped me grow as a person, as a player. I will never find somebody that made as big as an impact on my career as he did, just because I wouldn't have been here without his grace. Truly, like, there's nothing anybody could say to me that's going to take him from the top spot in my mind. Like, that guy is good in my book always.
I mean, I think for Kobe, you know, I think there's probably a level of like a forgiveness with players entering the league when they were all kids once as well, who probably went through a phase hating Kobe Bryant. Whether it was for, you know, the stuff that happened in 03 in Colorado, or whether it was on court personality. I mean, as a fan, I used to hate Kobe. Yeah. I hated Kobe. Like, in those 2000s years, I was like, this guy doesn't pass the ball. He's a ball hog, bad teammate. And then, like, growing up a Celtics fan, the Celtics faced Kobe and the Lakers in the finals. And like, there's an admiration of Kobe where it's like, mm-hmm. Oh my God, this guy is a killer. He's everything that I love in Tom Brady. He's everything like Yankees fans love in Derek Jeter and all these great athletes, these great players. You admire them for that, just that killer instinct, that mindset. And so over the years, it's like the hate grew into love to hate, grew into really admiring and loving him as a player in his latter years and appreciating him for who he was. So I think for Kobe, there's probably, as wise as he was as a person, there's probably a level of self-awareness, like, of course, you know, I have my haters.
Kobe Bryant. I mean, honestly, I'll never forget what he said. He was like, man, I've been called worse. Water under the bridge, welcome to the team. And it was like, so just like cavalier about it all. Just very like, yeah, I've seen worse. It's just very, 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 that's a strong person. So like you said, like I grew up hating him. I'm from Cleveland. You know what I mean? It was Bron, it's Cavs, it's Bron, everything. That's how I grew up. And so, you know, it was Bron and Kobe. And of course, like, I'm from Akron, Ohio. Like, Bron is my guy. And then, of course, as I got older, I went to college. And, you know, it's funny. I took a public speaking class my junior year. And I still have the PowerPoint. I'm almost positive I still have the PowerPoint. And what I did my public speaking on, 30 minutes of nonstop, was why I thought Kobe at that point had a better resume and was a better player than LeBron.
Wow.
And so I stood up there in front of, yeah, like, I flipped because like, I grew up in Akron, and then like, and then he went to the Heat. So I, you know how it goes. Like, he went to the Heat and I turned allegiances, but like, I had a full PowerPoint presentation on why this guy is like my hero to this point, like just because of the things he fought through and all that. But then just to be on the same team with him and him just, again, giving me the grace that he allowed was, I just can't imagine what more I could do in my career to top that. And I don't know, man. It's hard to beat.
I mean, talking about it with you makes it, you know, even more understandable. I mean, the first game you played following his death, there was the footage of you, you know, tears in your eyes, crying on the bench, and obviously very emotional. What do you remember about that game in particular, how hard it was to play that game?
I'm not an emotional person. Like, that's not, like, I hate that is out there.
It's okay. There's nothing because wrong with being vulnerable and feeling. There's not.
You're right. But for me, like, that's just not who I am. I'm not like I'm not an emotional, like, a crier. Like, when I found out, I didn't cry. It was just a very solemn, like a solemn feeling that I got.
So but it just hit you that night, like before the game or during the game.
Yeah, like during the national anthem, for whatever reason, I was fine shooting around. I was fine. And then during the national anthem, like, we had the moment of silence and it just ate me up. That was not planned. That was not, like, I hadn't cried to that point. Like, I just happened. And I mean, it's, you know, the game, I can't tell you what happened in the game. I don't know whether we won or lost. I don't care. And I would have told anybody that asked at that point, like, do you care? No, I don't. There was just something bigger. There's something bigger going on. But then when we play the next home game for the first half, I don't know why I did it, but something I wanted to do. I saw a few guys doing it, so I wanted to do it myself as well. And I wore 24 for the first half of, like, the first half of our next home game. And I've still got that jersey just because it should mean something to me. Wore it for a half. I don't even know how well I played. Doesn't matter. It was just like, it meant something to me. So that's hanging up in my house.
It's pretty crazy, man. Like, I mean, at the time in my own life, my dad, you know, he had stage 4 cancer. He was, you know, about 3 weeks before he passed away, Kobe died. And this at this point with my dad, like, he couldn't really speak much, right? Like, the cancer was so bad, like, he really just mumbled through things. And when Kobe died, I told him, and he's like, you know, mumbling, you know, didn't he just retire? Isn't he young? And like, it was like one of the last times that I had like a back and forth with him, because like, it kind of almost perked him up in the sense that it was just like, how is this real? For a guy who was like on his deathbed, pretty much, it was what the hell? Kobe?
Yeah.
Kobe felt invincible. Like, and that's, I think that, like, for me in my own life, that, like, is an example of how the world reacted, where it was just like, how? Like, Kobe?
The other shoe has to drop, right? Like, this happened, but he's fine. Like, he's okay. Like, we were just waiting for, like, he's okay. Like, he got out. He survived, because, like, this dude is larger than life. Like, he is a real-life superhero. Just a shame. But, yeah, no, you're right. That feeling of, like, that jolt. It's just one of our heroes, you know, the guy is larger than life, and it didn't seem real.
Yeah. I mean, I think for me, like, you know, obviously, you know, everybody has their own examples in their respective lives, but I think with Kobe in particular, one of the examples was, you know, making the most of your time. Like, Kobe, I mean, it's horrible what happened. But like, he was with his daughter, you know, many parents were with their kids on that helicopter, enjoying their time together, you know, doing something that they love together. And Kobe, I think throughout especially his latter years, the way he talked at conferences and in interviews, talking about his mindset and his approach, the Mamba mentality, I think forever, a lot of those lessons and experiences are going to make an imprint on people. Like, for Kobe, it was almost more than the game. It was what was going on between the ears for him with the lasting impact, what I think prompted that big reaction. Did you kind of sense that type of mindset from Kobe that you know, with your rookie year? Like, was he talking kind of in that philosopher type of way a lot of the time around you guys?
A little bit. I mean, he was obviously, any question you had basketball wise, like, done. He couldn't wait to talk ball with us. But like, bigger picture again, like you could see him starting to like break out of that like basketball is the world mindset and like okay, because I've done this at such a high level, like what does that lead me to? And he was starting to, like, you could see him, like, you'd ask him a question about like, hey man, should I have cut right there? And he'll like, yeah, you should have cut because of actions like this, and talk about basketball. And then just like, you could see him kind of like loop that into general existence. And it's like, oh man, like you're going to be a sick speaker when you're done.
Cause like, it did kind of come just, after, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, he was just very, again, with how worldly he was and, you know, how capable of sharing his knowledge and experience. Like, man, I just, yeah, you could see him start to speak in words that were like less so basketball and more just general life themed.
I'm sure he wasn't philosophical when he told you to get up off the bench and sit on the floor.
No, but like, it's funny that clip shows up every now and again, and I love it. I love it. I really do, because like, that's a rite of passage in the NBA. Right. Like, that's just what we do. When an older guy who has more years comes in and says, like, you have a spot, like, hey, I need that spot. You got it. Your years outmatch mine. I have respect for you and what you've done. It's yours. That's just across any sports league in the world. Anybody would tell you that. But, you know, specifically that, it was like, the dude could ask for the shirt off my back and I would give it to him. You know, it that's Kobe Bryant. Like, he could ask for, hey, can I have those shoes? Yes. Whatever you need, dude. It's yours. And, you know, what's cool is like, that became like a routine for us. Like, once that kind of like blew up online, we talked about it and he was just like, it's so silly what people take and run with now. But like, it became like a, you know, whenever he would come out from the locker room, I'd like make sure I was aware of him and, you know, present his seat to him rather than having to get up myself. So it became just like a inside joke with us and you know, just led to a stronger relationship, which was pretty cool.
This might be a silly question, but like you mentioned earlier how like nobody obviously wanted to piss him off. You wanted to give maximum effort and all that. But the flip side is like, there's some clips I found on YouTube where you guys are like the bench, the young guys are going crazy, a little rally, down 15, now you're down 8. Like, you're just going nuts. Mm-hmm. And then the camera pans to Kobe and it's just deadpan. Were there moments that you guys didn't want to look too happy around Kobe?
No, because he never made us feel, he never made us feel judged for it. You know, mm-hmm. he knew like Julius was 20, D'Angelo was 19, JC was 21, mm-hmm. I was 21. Like, we're kids, you know, we were just kids on the Lakers. And so it was sick. Like, we were just living our lives you know, he wouldn't ridicule or put us down for that at all. It was very much so like, yeah, like, have your fun. Now, like, if we're losing and you're laughing, that's not funny. And like, that has stayed with me forever. Like, if we lose a game, it's not funny. There's no laughing in the locker room. It is, let's get out of here. Let's leave. You know, it's not a joke.
Is that a lesson you've kind of taken as you've gone from young player to now a veteran in the NBA, where it's like you kind of, you know, pass that along to some of the young guys?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we play 82 of them. You know what I mean? So like, it's very easy to get caught up in like the one game. Like, yeah, we lost it. Some, you know, we lost. That happens. We gave our best. Like, it happens. Nobody has won every game yet. So, you know, getting too high or low on any given game is counterproductive, in my opinion. But like, very much so after losses, it's like, once the coach leaves, it's business.
When you obviously your dad was a former NBA player as well, played with Kobe, he won a dunk contest, and then, you know, 13 years later, Kobe Bryant won a dunk contest. You were, I think, 4 or 5 years old at the time, but do you remember anything about that? Did your dad's cool factor go up at the time after Kobe won it?
No, I honestly, I didn't get into basketball till late. Like, so I didn't, him winning the dunk contest, I have no recollection really of him winning it, like, at the time he won it. But what made it that much cooler was like when I did it and got to see everything that goes into it, and, you know, kind of experiencing it for myself, and then see, being like, damn, my dad won that. like the very first ever. That's pretty cool. Yeah. The longer I've gone in my career, the more impressive my dad has become to me, because you start to realize like what it takes to belong, what it takes to get here, what it takes to stay here. So the longer I'm in, the more kudos I have to give him. Never to him, though. I'll never tell him this.
Why not?
No,
you're saying it right now. Wait, maybe your dad's a listener, and he's gonna be like, "Oh, thank you, Larry. I appreciate it."
My dad doesn't use the internet. He
he's a one finger texter.
Yeah, that is a boomer if I've ever seen one. He is. My man does not use the. He won't see any of these clips. That's for sure.
Maybe he's got the right idea. Life without the internet might be pretty satisfying.
Sounds pretty well. Look, I've got whenever the sand runs out of my hourglass in the NBA, that might be me. Just sign off. I'll just be on my little farm in Cleveland and see me there.
That sounds like a pretty good life, Larry. Last question here about Kobe. You've been teammates with, you know, a bunch of different superstar players over the years. I'm curious, like, as you kind of assess those guys over the years and have had them as different teammates, what are some of the qualities that you feel have kind of differentiated Kobe from those other great players that you have played with?
I think the thing with him is just, again, you know, it's not fair to him. I caught 40-year-old Kobe on his last season, so it's not fair to him to speak on like his preparation, you know, and all that stuff, because he was just trying to get by, you know. At that point, there was so much ice on him and everything like that after games. He was just trying to get by. But the biggest thing I've noticed, again, Bron, Dame, Trey, now Zion, I've gotten to play, beat Brandon Ingram, some, I don't want to leave anybody out, some really talented basketball players. And I think the biggest difference for me was just like in game, how locked in he was. Like I could walk up to any of the guys that I've played with before and be like, yo, you see so-and-so, like so-and-so's here, or like, you know, Jay-Z is sitting courtside or whoever, and it's an instant like, really? Like, you get excited. It's just natural. But like, he almost like wasn't human in that sense, where like there was nothing that was more important than that game. And like, sure, if he's out of the game, or if he's the games before the game, after the game, sure, got time for you. But like, if it's in the game, if you're not talking to me about the game, that's not. You know, let's not. I'm not going to sit here and discuss being in Brooklyn. Like, I my first game, and I'm like, you know, the first game I got to play in is in Brooklyn, and Alicia Keys is sitting right there. And it's like, I'm, you know, I love me some Alicia Keys. And so, like, I'm hyped. I'm telling Julius, I'm telling Roy, whoever's out there with me. And then, but like, I knew, like, I didn't, I'm not bringing it to that guy. No, like, he would call me, like, pay attention. We're playing a game. Like, I know, I wouldn't have brought it to him, just because, you know, he's just so locked in. The game was, it was, you couldn't break him from his focus.
Favorite Alicia Keys track?
Oh, I mean, if it's not, if I Got You is,
yeah,
it might be a top 10 song ever for me.
It's an all-timer. Fallen's a great one, too. That was, like, I think her first or second hit. Excellent.
Fallen's a good one. A little bit of trivia for you. I took sign language in high school, and our final exam was to be able to sign a full song. I did Fallen. So.
Oh wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Perform that in front of my class.
That's cool. Do you retain any of it at all, or is it just all escaped you at this point?
No, I'm pretty fluent in sign. Yeah.
Wow.
ASL.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I took it 4 years in college, 4 years in high school. So I just couldn't do Spanish, man. Couldn't do it.
That's awesome. That's cool. I took 4 years of French, two in middle school, two in high school. I don't remember any of it.
I was gonna say if you retained any of that, you could come down to Atlanta right now and help me talk to these guys down here, because Clint speaks French. Our new rookie Zach speaks French. These guys, so far over my head.
You get a lot of them. You got a fun team in Atlanta right now, Larry. I appreciate you joining me today to talk about the life and celebrate the life of Kobe Bryant. Thank you.
Absolutely. Appreciate you having me on.
Big thank you to Larry Nance Jr. and Tom Haverstraw for coming on today's episode. Thanks to Father John Misty for the music. Thanks to Emmy and Mike for producing. And thanks to you for giving us a listen. Please give us a 5-star rating if you're listening on audio, a thumbs up on YouTube. It really does help out the show. Hope you have a great weekend. We'll be back next week.